Welcome to our Roughing the Passer podcast. It's a Monday, and week 14 is in the books. Can you believe it's week 14 already, guys? I'm joined by Brady Quinn and Pat Curran. Pat, I always say if the life went as fast as the NFL season, we all be dead by, like, next Wednesday.
You ain't kidding. These weeks, because they're all programmed, every minute of every day for all three of us is like, we know what we're supposed to be doing, and it's all football. It's funny when it's over, because I really don't know what to do with myself for like 2 weeks.
I think the interesting thing, Pat, to me was always as a player, it kind of felt like training camp would drag on, and then all of a sudden week one to week 17 flew by. And you kind of thought, you know, your team was one thing going into the season, and then at week 17 you're able to look back and really see what you were after it was all said and done.
You know, it's one big grind for all of us. It is for the players, it is for us in this business. You know, Brady, you did a game in Cleveland, you had to fly home. It's a grind. But we love the grind. You know the schedule, you know what it is. It's kind of like we're creatures of habit. Like Saturday night, normally when I fly into town here, I get in the hotel room and I nestle in and watch some good college football. There was nothing on. I was like having withdrawal symptoms. Pat, I know that feeling, like at the end of the season, you don't know what to do with yourself.
I will be sad on the first Monday night there is no football, and I hate to say it because I never liked it, but I'll be sad when Thursday night football is gone too. I have my programmed life into those two things. But Brady, your comment though about how things fly by and who we are later as compared to who we were in August at camp really relates to these teams, because I was fooled by a few teams. I was fooled that they were going to be really good. And then I was fooled by a couple I thought would be bad. And teams like Jacksonville, Pete's team, a pleasant surprise. And really, almost time to get excited about the future of that team. They better not get rid of that coach.
Oh, they're not going to get rid of that coach, Pat. I've been told he's coming back and probably should. I think they'll get rid of, and I haven't been told this, but I think they're going to get rid of the defensive coordinator. I think Bob Babich could be in trouble there. They've been bad on defense. But here's the other thing about that team. You know, this is the first time they scored 50 in franchise history in the regular season, because they put 62 on Dan Marino in his last game in the playoffs. But they have $60 million to spend in free agency. And you're making a face, Brady. You don't like that idea.
Yeah, because I think I just did a game with the Cleveland Browns. They're the highest paid defense in the NFL, and they were in last place going into this last week. Now, that'll change because they had 9 sacks against the San Francisco 49ers, but I think they had literally spent, the number might be $60 million, and they're last place in the NFL.
If I told you this team, Jacksonville's offense as is, maybe they had an offensive lineman going into next year, but they add three of these guys, three of them. Pick your pick, Pierre Paul, Von Miller, Josh Norman, Olivier Vernon, Bruce Irvin. They had three of that group. Eric Weddle. Throw Eric Weddle in for maybe you get a veteran stability. So three of that six, and then you get Fowler and Marks coming back off injuries, and Fowler being like an extra first-round pick, and then you use your first three picks in the draft on defensive guys. Is that a playoff team in 2016?
If you get Von Miller and Josh Norman, then I think, yeah, it's going to help. But obviously those draft picks have to be able to contribute and have to be able to hit home, and you've got to get Marks back to what he once was.
And Fowler.
And Pat, I'll ask you this, and Pete, because you alluded to it earlier, Pete, Mario Williams. You know, that's one of those things, you pay a guy, you bring him in, and all of a sudden he's not living up to this huge contract and all this money that you're paying him. And Pat, I'd be curious to see, I mean, how do you see them allocating that $60 million?
Well, I've made the big mistake. I did spend, under the direction of our owner, we had one of those years where we went out, we had a lot of cap space, and we signed 2 starting offensive tackles, a starting wide receiver, a quarterback, and one other player. Major, major salary. So it didn't work out. Those guys, after they cashed the checks, didn't really want to be there. They felt they wanted to be mercenaries and they wanted the money, but they really had their hearts other places. Number two, they didn't blend in well with the young players we were nurturing as the core of the team. And number three, we had a coaching change 1 year later, and some of their skill sets didn't fit with the next guy that was there. So I caution everyone, starting with myself, to be careful about doing too much. If you tell me 1 or 2 guys, and if you ever told me Von Miller and Josh Norman, both will be franchise tagged if they were free. But if you could get 2 guys, okay. But you start dabbling in 3 and 4, And a guy like Eric Weddle, I wouldn't pay him. He, you know, he could come. He's the kind of guy that lands up on the Patriots for like $1 million, something small. Unless you are completely set in your core. That's why the Patriots can pull it off, because there's a culture in there with Brady. You know all about it, Brady Quinn. But the really, if you go in that area and say we're gonna get ourselves over the top with unrestricted free agents, there's not a lot of history that says that works.
But, and Tom Coughlin told me this a long time ago. He said, if you're going to target a free agent, make sure he's 26 years old in that area. So that way you know he's had good years behind him, but he's got a lot of football in front of him. And, Pat, I don't know which guy. You're talking about the O'Donnell free agency class. Is that the one you're talking about? And you signed the – I mean, who were the guys that you signed?
Well, Jeff Graham had broken the record for the Chicago Bears on receptions and receiving yards. And we wanted a player – to compliment Keyshawn Johnson on the other side. We signed Jumbo Elliott, who landed up playing for the Jets for a lot of years. But after the coaches got fired and he was back with Parcells, that's what saved him. David Williams was coming out of the Houston Texan organization. We got him fairly cheap. We should have signed Lomas Brown because Lomas landed up playing a lot longer. David got a neck right away, and he was done. It was just not a lot of chemistry. And Ronnie Lott and I talk about it all the time. Even when we brought Ronnie there, and he was old and he couldn't run anymore, but guess what? There were players there that were in a hostile mood that he was there. And they perceived him as trying to take over the leadership role, and which he wasn't. But they said, well, he'll try to be the leader here. And the guys that were, in their minds, the leaders before, they were hostile to that thing, and it doesn't really work out. You cannot overhaul your roster or inject 4 and 5 or 6 guys onto the team and expect your team to continue forward. We all talked about Jimmy Graham earlier today, and Brady made the comment, and justifiably so, that he's on the bench and they're back to what they are and who they were and what they're doing. And they're doing just fine with the young kid they got at tight end right now. So maybe that's the point that has a bigger range than just the example of Jimmy Graham. So you got to be really smart about it and really careful. And the last thing I'll say, and this is a DeMarco Murray comment, you should never take a free agent if you expect to do something different with him than what's on film. If you bring in a guy, and Byron Maxwell's another example, they took him off a cover 3 team. They tried to play man. He gets beat all the time. You got to be so smart. You just look, DeMarco Murray belongs in an I position, a dot tailback guy, and downhill. Everything else, you are just risking your life trying to think, I'll get him to do something else. So that's my recommendation to everyone who says to me, what do you think of this free agent? I always go, are you going to do exactly what you see on film? Because if you're not, don't do it.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned Pete, 26 years old, because I spoke with Jed York before the game this past weekend, and he was really, really high on Blaine Gabbert and talking about the fact that he's only 26 years old. And he kept kind of coming back to that as, you know, he's got this tremendous shelf life still left, that he's still developing and getting better as a quarterback. And he really felt like after seeing him throw the game-winning touchdown in overtime and run for the touchdown to essentially help them, you know, get into overtime, he really felt like there was a possibility that he could have grown or could grow into this guy that could at least compete to be the quarterback of the future, not just be a stopgap. Now, after this past week's performance, I don't know that he feels the same, but he also didn't get a whole lot of help, so that's not necessarily on him. But I do find that interesting, though, that age 26 kind of comes around, because that's usually about the time where most players, if they're a first round, second round, whatever, they kind of get close to that second contract. So it's essentially, that's at that second contract, they're either hitting it big or they're still trying to struggle to survive and be in the NFL.
They also should be in their prime at 26. I mean, or move into their prime. You know what I mean? They've had a couple years of playing time. They've done some good things. Now they're hitting the market at 26. Whereas if you sign a 30-year-old guy, you know, that's a problem. The one thing I wanted to ask you, and I think this is a problem in Jacksonville right now, and I think it's a problem in Atlanta right now. When you blow draft picks, and Jacksonville blew a bunch of draft picks for a period of time, Atlanta's blown a bunch of draft picks, you look at their roster, you don't have homegrown vets. How important is it to sustainable success in the NFL to have homegrown vets like Seattle does on the roster or Green Bay?
To me, it's pivotal because the culture in the locker room as a player, you would like to keep some continuity and keep it the same. And I think players feel a sense of home and feel a sense of onus to their team that drafts them because they were the ones that took a chance on them. They're the ones that have given them the first opportunity, right? You always remember your first one. And that applies to more than just, you know, life. That applies to football as well. Right.
And life.
And in this particular case, I think you look like you look at a guy like Joe Thomas, for example, who's been there. He was there, you know, in 2007 through a ton of coaching changes and all this stuff. And from talking with him, he just said it's really hard to continue to keep starting over, not only with an offense and all that, but that bond with your players, that bond with the younger guys. You know, it's hard to try to, you know, be the older figure to help them grow and develop as a player when they're only around for a year or two. So when a team then, you know, has a guy like him, where at least in Joe's case, he's been able to stay there, and then they've obviously compensated him well. But at least in his case, he's been kind of that stable figure where I think...
But you need four or five of those kind of guys.
Yeah, you'd like
or
to
six
have...
Or seven.
Yeah, you'd like to have as many as possible. And I think that's the difference between teams that have success and those that don't, are the ones that can have that higher number of guys who have been able to be there. I mean, you look at the Pittsburgh Steelers. I mean, that's really the team that I think a lot of people maybe base it off of. You watch them, how those players continue to grow and get better and better. I mean, Ryan Shazier, from his rookie year to now, I know he's injured, but from his rookie year to now... He's just completely changed. He's gotten better and better and better. Lawrence Timmons, same thing. I mean, all those guys have gotten better and better the longer they've been in that system, been able to grow.
But also, Green Bay is another example. I think Seattle, too. But in talking to players, when you have, for example, in Jacksonville, Julius Thomas is a veteran player, but he's not a homegrown veteran player. So he comes there, and he's got to instill himself into what's already there or try and take over the culture, whereas if, and Pat, you know this because you put together a roster. When you draft those guys and develop them, those are the guys that are the guys setting the culture and making the, you know, forever all the young guys.
It's a double-edged sword because I agree with build through the draft and sprinkle in the free agents. I like the idea of one or two marquee free agents every other year, not every year, flowing them in. And I don't mind the intelligent pickups of a D'Angelo Williams here, there, and everywhere for less money than you'd pay for a big time guy if you do your homework. But this all comes down to the personnel office, both the pro and the college. A, they got to be synchronized in that they're talking to each other. The pro guys in some places just think, oh, we'll just get veterans. And the other guys are thinking just draft picks. You got to figure out how to talk to each other and communicate. Then neither group, and this is what your point is, Pete, can make mistakes. The more mistakes you make, the more, because a college draft mistake up top is probably like a five-year phenomenon, one guy, by the time you figure it out. If you go to a place, and I'm torn between which way is the right way, you know, the personnel people will fight like crazy to keep the kid on the roster for 4 years. Because they're just waiting for the development, the light to go on. And there's plenty of examples of it going on. The coach doesn't think he has 4 years, so he wants the guy out of there basically after his first camp. So you have that problem. And go back to Jed York for a second. What's in Jed's mind? What's his experience? Well, he was a little kid ball boy at the 49ers, and he saw them trade for Steve Young, who was basically a failure in Tampa. I was coaching there. I've talked about it before on the show. And they were happy to get rid of him. And he went there. And no one really knew that he was going to be any good. So when he blossomed into the Hall of Famer that he is, you know, I think guys like Jed, young guy, he thinks he can strike gold. You got to be careful out thinking that you can't talk yourself. If you're talking yourself into it, then you should be talking yourself out of it. Give him a nice little, you know, modest 3-year deal. Look at him as a backup. And if he surprises you in a year or two, God bless him. But if you start talking yourself into, hey, he could be the guy, he might have what it takes, you're in dangerous place.
You know, I think the one interesting perspective I want to kind of throw out there, because we're kind of talking it more from like the team's perspective, is how important it is for a free agent, and we mentioned DeMarco Murray, how important it is for him not to chase the money. or at least not that contract. Maybe if it's more incentive laden, then that allows him the opportunity to go be in a system that's going to utilize his skills and attributes and the culture that he's going to feel comfortable in. And that's the hardest thing as a free agent from going from it. You know, I had the opportunity to go back to Denver on a 2-year deal as opposed to I worked out a 1-year deal with Kansas City back in, 2012. And at the time, I was like, well, I know Romeo Crennel's the head coach, so I understand the culture and everything he wants to build and everything else. Brian Daboll's there. I knew his system, or at least I had an idea of what kind of stuff he wanted to run from a previous experience. And the roster on paper looked great. The problem was is one, I turned down money to kind of chase that opportunity. And then two, obviously, that culture, the locker room, everything they had kind of battled and been through already, I didn't have a sense or a feel for, because when you go on those visits, you're basically talking with, you know, the personnel front office people, the coaches, and all that. You're not necessarily talking to quite as many players or able to go through like what it feels like to be in an OTA and those sorts of practices and able to watch how they work. And when once you're able to do that, that's when you're really able to get a feel for like whether or not you'd fit and see all that. And as a collegiate player, a guy who's in high school going to the collegiate level, you kind of have that opportunity when you're visiting places, right? You go to games. You go up there and see that. You see them practice. You can visualize yourself and how you would fit into that culture as opposed to the NFL. It's that dead period. I mean, you're going at a time of the year when no one's there.
Would you have been better off taking the Denver deal, you think?
100%. Well, one, it was for more money, but two,
you turned down more money to go to Kansas City?
Yeah, because at that point in my career, I wanted an opportunity to play, and I didn't know what was going to happen in Denver, because at the time, there was rumors, obviously, of Peyton going, but I didn't know. I didn't want to wait on Peyton and have other opportunities to miss out on, and then Tebow is still there at the moment. So I didn't want to go back and have to sit behind that whole mess and situation.
Yeah.
So I was like, I want to move on. I think I might have a chance to play here in KC. And from going into it, what it looked like on the roster going into it, it looked like a great scenario.
All right, let's move on to some football from Sunday. And one of the things that stands out, particularly if you're a Bengals fan, is the fact that Andy Dalton broke his thumb. I mean, it is a damning blow to the Bengals, at least in my mind. I thought this team had a real legitimate chance to push into possibly be a Super Bowl team. They're talented. He was playing great football. The offense is working. Hugh Jackson's a good coordinator. I think they're talented on defense. Where are they now? Is there any chance at all in either one of your minds that A.J. McCarron can step in? Pat, we'll start with you. And A.J. McCarron can step in and get this team maybe to the championship game?
No.
No.
No. And a couple reasons why. Nothing about AJ here. He's never played. So we're asking a kid with no experience. And I've been charting backup quarterbacks all year. And the guys that are out there that were never really starters, they're struggling. And they're struggling on good teams. So for you to ask me the question to the championship game, no. Do I think they're going to win the division anyway? Yeah. They got a winnable game this week. They'll win it. They have a good supporting cast. You can run the ball with this crowd. Paul Alexander's linemen will do a pretty nice job. You can throw to an elite player. Brady talked about it this morning. But when you get into the games where you might have to go to Foxborough now because you're going to land up being a 3 seed, you might have to play your opening round without, because you're going to have to not get a bye and you have to play a round without them. No, I don't think they can do it. And I love a lot of things about the team. But you got a group of players here. You look around that roster. How many guys have ever won a playoff game? Probably none. So how are they going to get that done? How are they going to overcome it? Who goes in to a playoff game with a backup quarterback with no experience and tries to, you know, legitimately pull it off against Roethlisberger or against Peyton Manning or any of these guys? I think when the dust settles and we see the playoff teams, no, he can't do it.
What about if they get a bye?
Well, they're going to have to – AJ, to get that to happen, AJ's going to have to beat the Denver Broncos, right, in 2 weeks?
Right.
No.
Let me bring this up. I'm curious to get your opinions on this. So in 2 weeks, they play the Broncos like we're talking about.
Yeah, week from
if yeah, Peyton's close, does he come back to get that win to ensure the Broncos' position in the playoffs? in comparison to the Bengals. That's one thing that's been lingering
in other words,
in my mind.
If he's still got a little bit of a problem with the foot.
Yeah, like at what percentage do you think he goes in and takes the chance of playing and not re-injuring it or re-aggravating
well, you're the foot
it?
Guy. You've had problems with your feet all the time.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know how it's, you know, it feels to him. I don't know how it's affecting him. And I'd be just curious to see at what percentage does he feel like he's at this point to make that decision. I mean, and I guess the way I look at it is he was playing with it before, essentially. I don't know if at the end of when he last was playing, if he made it that much worse, or if it's just a matter of, all right, they're trying to let it heal now until they really need him to come back in and play. Well, this would be a scenario where I think they would need him to come back into play to then allow them the opportunity to have home field advantage and not allow the Bengals to kind of take over. Because I think that changes the playoffs dramatically.
So basically, yeah. And so to answer the question, do you think they can win a playoff game, get to the championship game if they have a bye? Or
what, then if that allows Dalton to come back? Yeah. I think they do
so
in that
Pat,
case.
If they got the bye somehow, you would say yes, that they'd have a chance.
Right, but here's what's going to happen. They're going to have to play in Denver with AJ.
Right.
I'll give them a loss right there, number
you would
one. Yeah. Number two, now they've lost the tiebreaker to Denver. And so how do they even get past them with 2 weeks to go? There'd be slim chance in my mind that they would, because AJ's going to have to play the week after that, most likely. So I say this, there's two things going on at once here, because we just saw the Denver run game get shut down, all right, after 3 weeks of just having a great old time running the ball and Coops feeling like he's back in Houston with Arian Foster. If it gets shut down again this week, then there's really no reason to keep Osweiler on the field. Osweiler supposedly brought the run game to light because he had contain break skills and the boot came off it. Maybe guys just started to pile up on the run game and maybe having Anderson out's part of it. But at some point here, if you have to win the Bengal game and that basically assures you of the 2 seed, at least for now, with an eye on the 1 seed because you already beat New England, you're going to play Peyton Manning.
Okay, back to Dalton. Broken, fractured thumb, Brady. I look back, Jay Cutler in 2011 fractured his thumb in week 11 and didn't play again the rest of the season. Throwing thumb fracture on your throwing hand, how
impossible.
Damaging? Impossible for how long?
I mean, I've never had that particular injury. I've only had on my right index finger, which is equally important, if not more important. I think they're right there, 1 and 2, because it's the last finger that touches the ball. The thumb obviously ensures the grip of it, but also it's really when you're controlling the ball off your hand, your thumb has more control. Like it's like shooting a basketball. You use your left hand to kind of guide it. Your thumb has a big part in helping to guide the football with its placement in your hand. So it's kind of like your left hand shooting a basketball, if you want to make a comparison. So to me, I mean, that's a huge factor. I mean, a huge factor. And then it gets even worse, because as you go into the colder climates, and you don't have as much feel. When you lose feel, you don't have as good of a grip, as much control and the power and all that. And if it's already bothering you, that's not going to help either. So, but maybe he wears a glove. Maybe he finds a way of counteracting the lack of strength and the pain and all that in order to provide more of a grip.
Hey, Pat,
let me just ask Brady about the one part of this that he didn't cover, which I want to hear from him. Taking a snap, Brady, just for the listeners, taking a snap with a broken thumb, how much pressure of that ball coming up is going to be right on that thumb?
Well, it depends on how his hands are placed under center. You know, some guys, they'll place them where essentially they cross their thumbs and they almost put them both right under the center, like the seam of his pants, right down the middle. They'll receive a snap like that. Other guys, they'll flip their hands where their middle finger will split the seam of his pants directly down the middle, and they'll want the snap on the top hand. If that's really in either case, your thumbs are taking a lot of the beating, because if you're crossing your thumbs, they're receiving a lot of the result of that snap or the power of that snap. And if your top hand, which is your throwing hand, is on top, or Dalton's injured hand or thumb, if that's the case, that's on top, that's going to be taking a pounding, because you always want the ball to be snapped to the top hand every time, so then you can clasp it with your left hand to ensure the grip as you come away from center. So that might be an adjustment too for Hugh Jackson, their offense, where they have to go to shotgun because he doesn't have to go through that pain and how, you know, all that lingering stuff that's going on.
Hey, Julius Thomas had a thumb injury in the preseason. And at one point they said, and it's a different position, I get it, but they said, 4 weeks, whatever. And then they went back in and they had to put pins in it. And so my thinking is if they have to put pins in Dalton's thumb, then he's probably done for the rest of the year, no matter how far they go, no?
I had 6 weeks with pins in my right index finger. And
You played the first week with the injury, if I remember.
I played the rest of the game with it, and I tried to play the next week.
So 2 weeks, you played 2 weeks with it, then had pins put in it?
Yeah, because at that point, they were like, oh, you got benched. I got taken out because we talked about it on the sideline, and they're like, we just don't feel like you can throw effectively.
So 6 more weeks after the pin.
Yeah, so 6 weeks after the pin, and then after that, it took a while to kind of be able to get mobility back in and strength, obviously, because it's sitting there dormant for a while. Right. So I had to kind of go have like stim on my finger and do these little finger exercises.
God, that would be priceless to be able to see that.
I felt like a kicker. It was the first time of my life. I was like in the training room, and I was like, gosh, I feel like the biggest douche as a kicker.
I would love that. Oh, I wish we had old video of that, Pat.
The best is, I'm sitting there. I hit it off Marcus Stroud's helmet. In the first quarter of Monday Night Football game, right? And I think I just, like, stove my finger like you do in basketball sometimes. So I'm like, the next day we come in, and I've got blood underneath my fingernail, and our trainer's, like, trying to, like, literally drill a hole in to let the blood out, right?
Yeah.
Well, he's drilling. I'm like, dude, that really hurts. And he's like, stop being such a wuss about it, you know? He keeps drilling. He keeps drilling, and more blood's coming out. At this point, I'm like, I'm pretty sure he's drilling, like, through the nail, like, into my finger. The blood's not really coming out. Like it's there's something else down deeper that's affected. Finally, after practice on Wednesday, because I couldn't grip, couldn't throw the ball, wasn't getting better, we went and got X-rays, and they're like, "Oh yeah, you like shattered this and ripped off a bunch of ligaments. Like you're gonna need surgery." And I was like, "Well, let's see if we can get through this game and play." And it didn't end up being a good result.
So timetable: if he gets pins in, takes him out of the postseason.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically it. It takes him out of the postseason.
Yeah, and again, I don't know the specific injury.
No, but we're saying if he has to go put pins in for a fracture,
at this point,
he's pretty
much done. Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty much done.
So let's just wrap this one up with this. He's got the 49ers he's going to miss, the Broncos he's going to miss, which devastates their chances. Then they have the Ravens. Okay, they beat the Ravens. But because they lost to the Broncos, there's a really good chance they're playing January 10th.
Right,
that's 4 weeks from now.
Right, he's gone then, and then, you know what else happens then too, Pat? It goes back to your theory on the book. That'll be the fourth game that McCarron will have been in for four games, and so the book is out on him then, the full book, right?
He is what he is, and they will have plans for him. And that's not like the defense always gets the edge here, but you look around. Guys, that these freaking defensive coaches aren't stupid. You give them 3 or 4 games. What they understand is your escape lanes. They understand your audibles. They understand your favorite targets by down and distance. And they know what you're doing. You know, basically, they see how the coach changed his play calling to suit you. Those things add up. In 4 weeks, they can get a good feel for who you are. So you asked me, I was blunt to start. I'd love it to be a yes, but it can't be yes.
Hey, Pat, this is an anomaly because I don't know if I necessarily agree that it's just 4 games, but only because, you know, Mangini, we talked at length this week before they played Johnny Manziel and all that, and this is going to be his fourth start of the season. Now, he's played in like 6 games, but it was going to be his fourth start, and I think they did have a pretty solid game plan on as far as how to collapse the pocket out around him, and it did hit home. I think 2 or 3 times they got to him. But beyond that, man, I mean, it wasn't a very sound game plan. I mean, the Browns almost had 500 yards of total offense. They rushed for like 233 or something like that. I mean, it wasn't a very sound game plan, in particular on Johnny too, who besides one decision could have had his way with the.
I wanted to move on to Johnny Manziel. Johnny Manziel.
Fair point. He overcame that. It was. I would say this though: it wasn't 4 games in a row. It wasn't. Some of the information was from. What, a month ago?
Yeah.
But mostly when I was on with Carroll and Robinson and Monty Kiffin and those guys, you give them the last 4 games, they started to get, and it's mostly like Greg Robinson, he understood the pressure packages then. Okay, Here's where this guy's launch point is. It's not where it was before with the last guy. Now, launch points for Manziel is significantly different than Josh. So those are the things that we looked at a lot. And I live in fear of the quarterback who's on a little roll, Matt Hasselbeck. And then, bang, you're into that fifth game and people are starting to see how to play you.
Johnny Manziel. I thought he did a good job. And I mean, you know, like you said, the one throw across his body in the middle of the field, terrible decision, throw it out of bounds or whatever. But if Johnny Manziel plays the next 3 weeks the exact same way he played Sunday against San Francisco, has the similar numbers, same kind of production, is he the Browns' starting quarterback to open 2016?
I think so.
I mean, and should he be?
I think so, and I think if he plays that way, technically, yeah, because I feel like he'd be earning his way in. And I don't want to point to wins and losses as an indication of whether or not that should be the case, because this is what you always say, Pete. It's not about the wins and losses, that record. That shouldn't be a reflection on the quarterback, although people always tie it to him. So that will matter if they could win out. But I think if you look at the progress he's made, you know, watching film earlier this season, watching the Cincinnati game and the Pittsburgh game, one thing I noticed was in the Cincinnati game, when there was pressure, he didn't really reset his feet. He either scrambled out or he threw off balance. Pittsburgh, he really changed that. He either scrambled out of the pocket to make a play or he'd sat in there, got through his progressions, buzzed his feet around to his target, made the actual throws and all that, and it seemed like he improved. And then it was kind of hit and miss for San Francisco. There was times at which he kind of scrambled and got out of the pocket, maybe when he didn't need to. There were other times when I thought he threw off balance or he didn't have his feet in great positions where he could have. Now, in saying that, he made a one accurate throw where he wasn't great with his feet, another one he actually missed. But overall, you're starting to see more and more, you know, of that progression, that maturation. And, Pat, I'm curious because he did have that one glaringly bad play. Now, it started off ridiculous, right? He drops back. No one was there, starting to feel pressure, gets outside the rush, makes another guy miss in space, and then throws the ball back towards the middle of the field for a bad interception. But I kind of feel like Johnny Manziel gets off with the Brett Favre treatment. Like, it's part of what it makes and or embodies Johnny Manziel. So even though to us we say it's a mistake or it's glaringly obvious, I feel like it might be something that he never kicks from his game, and it might be something that people still are okay with because that's one out of every four of those times he does that where he makes a play like that. Another three times he's either getting positive yardage or getting a huge play for a touchdown. What do you think, Pat?
Yeah, well, he's a character, and he's got bigger-than-life persona about him. Certainly, I would say the young people, and I get those kind of callers on my show, they love the idea of him making it because they relate to him. So there's going to be some genuine excitement for him, and nothing else was going very good. He is 2-2 as a starter there. So when relatively speaking, they see him as a potential success story. Here's the answer to Pete's question on him, though, because Pete asked about if he plays well. I'm with you, Brady. I'm not judging it by wins and losses. I'm judging it by progress in his performance. There are things he does that are going to get him killed as it relates to ever being really good. You cannot retreat out of the pocket in the NFL and win. And he is not a guy who's going to step up. He likes to, because he thinks he's fast enough. I watched him yesterday. He'll back out of a pocket when pressure's around, which now he's getting deeper in trouble. And then he tries to go around the rush. And guys will start to mush rush him and just let him start to retreat, and then cut and treat him like a punt returner. We had guys that we had dealt with like that. So he's got to get over that somewhere. Here's all I'll say. His off-the-field world is, in my mind, isn't going away. And if it does, I'm glad to be wrong. So all he can ever get from me is the status of compete to start. And that might mean another draft pick. I can't trust him enough to give him the football team next year. Can't do it. He's 5'11", unaccomplished, with off-the-field habits. I'd love to see him win it, but I'm going to bring in somebody else, and Josh McCown will be there as well. But I'm bringing in another young guy, and maybe with a new coach. But you might think I'm harsh, but I just don't trust the whole package yet, and never will, to say it's your team.
Well, you have and I think Brady, Brady and myself both agree that they should draft somebody in the second or third round. And me, I'm a big believer you draft a quarterback at some point in your draft always. I mean, you're not going to use a first-round pick on him. You're not going to force that if you don't have to. But at some point in the draft, I think you draft a quarterback always. Take you know, you might hit pay dirt. You draft a guy in the sixth round like Tom Brady. Who knows? You got to me, I think you should draft a quarterback. And I think the Browns will be smart enough that they'll draft a quarterback and should.
Yeah, I agree with that. And here's the last piece. Brady, you got a sense of this probably yesterday. Maybe you didn't, but maybe you did. It sounds to me like everyone's going to be out of there at the end of this season. It's going to be hard for Haslam to hold on to anybody. So now you're bringing in a guy, and this is just like Jay Gruden. Jay Gruden goes into Washington swearing he can fix Robert. He wasn't there very long before he didn't want to coach Robert. So who could come in there with an open mind to John?
That's a good question. And I guess I'll try to pose another question in light of that is when I was doing my research for the game, you started to hear the rumblings of the people, their displeasure with what Pete mentioned, that everyone wants Pettine and Farman, everyone to be fired and cleaned out. And some people were saying, well, they even want Pettine to be fired now and have an interim head coach and all that so they could kind of start the coaching search. The interesting thing I came across was not one of his assistants has – any head coaching experience besides Chris Tabor, which is the special teams coach. And I think that was at an NAIA school. And I found that interesting because if you go back and look at like Rob Chudzinski, for example, when he was head coach for the Browns, he had Norv Turner, who had plenty of head coaching experience. And then Ray Horton, who was a very respected, long tenured defensive coordinator, who I think both could have probably fit the bill if indeed they were going to fire him. They were going to be an interim head coach. And I thought that was interesting because Pettine's almost kind of saved himself in the sense of there is no other plan B. So I guess sometimes the best plan B is plan A. And that's essentially what has happened where he's put himself in the position at least to be able to make it through the end of the season. But, you know, I get the feeling, at least from the players that I talked to there, that they really like Pettine. They really like Flip. I know it's Flip's first year as the offensive coordinator there in Cleveland, but he's actually done a pretty good job. I mean, Pat and Pete, answer this, I guess. If you had three quarterbacks start in a season for you, and their touchdown-to-interception ratio, which is now after this game, 20-8, they've thrown for 3,600 yards collectively, and obviously they've rushed for some or whatever else, right? But that actually, statistically speaking, is in the middle of the pack if you look at touchdown interception ratio and then yardage. And with what they have working with throwing to me, that's a win. I think Flip's done a great job. Kevin O'Connell's done a great job. I think for having three quarterbacks, that's pretty solid quarterback play, at least in the passing game. Am I wrong?
No.
No. He's done a good job with those guys. I got to give him credit for that, too. I mean, without any weapons. There are no weapons. There's nothing. They have nothing to throw to. They brought in Dwayne Bowe, who's a disaster. They lost Josh Gordon, who could have been good, but he's a disaster off the field. I mean, you know, they have no weapons. So, yeah, you got to give them credit for what they've done offensively. The defense is atrocious, though.
Yeah, but I guess going to the back, I mean, Pat, when you look at the scenario of the Browns, like I personally feel like Pettine could survive, but Farmer might not. Do you see that otherwise?
No, I think there's a lot of scenarios here, right? Both gone, both stay. One goes, the other stays, all that. If I was betting on the whole thing, I up till this week, I probably would have said both were gone after watching this. Because the one thing my owner always said, I was with four different head coaches. The owner always came down. It always came down to, are they still playing hard for him? Do they still believe in him? And your observation would indicate to me that they do believe in him. And I know Pettine well enough to know that players who like football will always like Mike Pettine. He's a football guy. He's pretty simple. He's not a dumb guy by any means. But I think there was a time the players on the team respected him because he wasn't playing Johnny. Now that Johnny's got to go, Johnny plays okay. They may perceive it as he's getting raised right, and now he's trying to respond responsibly. If I were the guys, I would probably keep the coach. But I would tell the next GM, you get 1 year, just like they gave the guys down in Carolina, 1 year to evaluate Ron Rivera. And Dave Gettleman said, okay, I'll do it. I'll take 1 year. No one thought Rivera was going to make it. They said, Gettleman will bring in his own guy. And I know Dave. I know both of them very well. And they fell into a relationship that they felt they could work together. So I think a GM, and you got to look at it, but they've already done that before. That's the problem, right? Mangini was kept on the, just keep him for 1 year, Mike Holmgren, and see what you see.
Are you guys bothered if you're hiring a coach, or are you going to even hire a coach if he's got no head coaching experience previously?
I wouldn't do it anymore. I mean, I shouldn't say I wouldn't. First, I'd have to study my owner. If my owner's impulsive and he's anxious and he's frustrated, I would only hire a veteran coach. If he gets it and he understands this is a process and it's going to take longer than people think, then I would. And sometimes, well, Pete can talk about this because Pete can tell us about the Jacksonville owner. But if you have a guy that gets it, then I'm inclined to really get the best young coordinator and mold him into our new program. That's why if you look at the Steelers, your reference all the time, Brady, is Cowher had no experience. Tomlin had 1 year as a 1 year as a coordinator, but they knew they weren't going anywhere. They were never firing the guy. These guys that feel like they got to fire the coach every 2 years, you're nuts to hire a young coordinator. You better hire a veteran.
Yeah, and the Jacksonville owner's patient. He understands it's a process. So I think Gus Bradley, who never had head coaching experience, is in a good place right now for another year. Now, if they don't get to the postseason next year, then he's in trouble. But I agree with you. I think patience matters. It depends if the owner's a quick trigger finger. And if he's not, then you can go get a coordinator. I don't, you know, like, for example, Gus Bradley has Doug Marrone on his staff. Doug Marrone was a head coach at one point. I mean, it helps. You mentioned Pettine didn't have any. Mike Pettine's relatively new to the National Football League. He was a high school coach a decade ago.
High school head coach. Yeah, that's his only head coaching experience.
So he doesn't know a lot of, you know, you know how the business is. And Pat, you know as well as anybody. A lot of it is who you know and who you're comfortable with and who you have relationships with throughout the years. And Pettine's relatively new to the NFL, so he's probably not going to have a lot of veteran coaches on his staff.
No, and he, you know, that's where the GM can help a young guy. But remember, Mike was hired before Farmer. So it was when Pettine was hired, Lombardi was in there and Joe Banner was in there. And I'm sure they're thinking, here's a young guy that we know communicates with players. We'll mold him. I think the best thing a GM can do for a guy like that is, look, you can hire whatever former head coaches you want, but I at least want one. Two would be preferable to me on your staff. Go interview those guys. And get the one or two you trust that you can work with. But you need that. When Bruce Cozzett was the head coach, never been a head coach, I just remember we had a former head coach on our staff. He would go down almost every Tuesday night. He went down and sat with him for 2 hours going over everything that a head coach should be thinking about. So who's doing that with Mike Pettine? Nobody.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. All right, let's switch gears before we wrap up and I'm going to sit here and take the abuse from both of you and take the abuse from every person in the city of Seattle, which I've been doing for the last day. Look, my whole criticism of Russell Wilson was based on the fact that I didn't think he was good and developed from the pocket. He left too many clean pockets. I thought that they kind of schemed things up for him. He was fantastic outside the pocket. He wouldn't stay there. He wouldn't let plays develop. I wasn't sure if he ever would get to that. What I've seen the last 4 weeks, and I went back and studied all three of his games on tape and actually wrote about it last week, the three previous to yesterday's game against Baltimore. And what I saw was a guy whose pre-snap reads are actually better than his on-the-field reads. And Brady, you would know this better than me because you played the position. And we always heard this about Peyton and his pre-snap reads, and he was one step ahead of you. How much more important is the pre-snap read to where you know where you're going with the football before the ball is snapped than maybe the on-the-field reads?
I'll compare it to this. I think everyone feels more confident in preparation, right? The more you prepare, the more confidence you have going into a game. A pre-snap read is kind of the same philosophy. The more confidence you have in your pre-snap read with what the coverage is going to be or what you think it's going to be allows you to work faster once the ball is snapped, whether you're under center and shotgun. So to me, that's why I feel like it's important to have a good idea or a good tell, so then you're not guessing, right? You're able to go back, get through your keys, but then get into your reads quick, and that way it doesn't throw off your timing. So that's where I feel like for Russell Wilson, you know, some of these things have probably been cleaned up a bit because, again, we talked about it. Jimmy Graham's not there. When you've got sometimes this explosive, you know, dynamic wide receiver where you're all of a sudden throwing to him regardless of coverage, which is kind of tough, right? Because it goes against the rules and everything you've been taught. Sometimes that can be difficult. But, I mean, sometimes you got to take chances for special players like a guy like Jimmy Graham. But in that case, I feel like it just wasn't really working with their offense. I'll also say this. Give their offensive line a little bit of credit, too. I think Tom Cable's done a good job. They've improved as the season's gone along. And that seems to be something that they're always battling through, always working on. And it's probably a little bit because the run game's still been effective with Rawls, with Lynch out. So I think that's part of it because they've kind of always had that balance. But they've also improved. But I think it's allowed Russell Wilson to really probably have more confidence in his ability to have all that pressure on his shoulders to be the guy to carry their offense, in particular in the passing game, because he's more confident in what he's seeing before the snap, and that helps him work through his progressions quicker and better a little bit earlier than maybe he was at the beginning of the season.
I don't even know if he's because in the throws I watched in the 3 weeks, he didn't even have to get to the second progression a lot of the time. I mean,
that's making it more of a case than for the play caller.
I think the play caller's done a fantastic job.
So then you got to give Daryl Bevel more credit for him calling better games and him being able to essentially have that number one, number two guy being open right away.
Yeah, I think they've done a fantastic job. And Pat, you know that staff very well, but Daryl Bevel took a ton of criticism last year for the play, obviously at the end of the Super Bowl. But I think what Pete has done and what Daryl Bevel has done is they've given more to him. It's not like, you know, they were so reliant on the run game and that read option stuff. He doesn't even run that much of that anymore. He doesn't take off much at all anymore. The last 4 weeks of the season, he's done a great job, and they've done a great job of scheming things open, and he's had a lot of easy throws. And you've seen it, Pat. How many times do you sit there and guys are wide open against that offense?
Yeah, well, and they have a quick strike mentality. It is a lot of first read, but it's off the run. The little play action pass, fake, and then that little fast inside seam route, they're very good at that. The question will become in the next 2 weeks, not so much this week with Cleveland, but maybe even, how legitimate are they going to treat the running attack? No one's ever played the Seahawks with the idea of Lynch was the guy we have to set our coverages to. No, we set the coverage to the run game. But now, without Lynch, without Rawls, you know, it's going to be Wilson. And Brady, I'd expect some different coverages. If you can't convince your opponent, that being Seattle, that you're a power run team still, a big zone run scheme, they might start tweaking coverages to a place where you haven't seen a lot of what they're going to do before.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the toughest part to me about trying to go up against Russell Wilson, because if you drop eight and you try to flood all those, you know, passing lanes and all that, eventually he's going to scramble around and find a guy. And I almost feel like you have to have a similar game plan to that of what Mangini tried to do against Manziel. When you have a smaller quarterback, you got to bring outside edge pressure with some of those dime and nickel packages, and it then forces the quarterback to feel like he has to step up. But then you have to have those two stout guys getting push and penetration from that D-tackle position to then just collapse the pocket out around him and contain him. And that's the most effective way, because one, it takes away vision, right, of a smaller quarterback being able to see over his lineman or over the defensive lineman as well to see downfield. And then two, when you have guys kind of dropping out, you lose them a lot of times because your first instinct is, okay, am I hot? Am I not? Do I need a sight adjust? Do I not? And then you're trying to get your eyes back over to wherever your first read is in that progression. And a lot of times in doing that, you lose some of those guys who are dropping back out. And then you combine that with a lack of vision because of the offensive line, because of the pressure. All of a sudden, you've created an opportunity for there to be some mistakes, interceptions, things of that nature.
Before we get out of here, one of my all-time pet peeves is when – and it comes from the Russell Wilson camp a ton, is they send out these stats about pocket passing numbers. And me personally, when I watch and I go back and I watch and I watch these three games, I studied them. When I see a quarterback stand up and throw a ball 4 yards behind the line of scrimmage to a wide receiver and he rips off and breaks three tackles and runs for 21 yards.
That's not a pass in the pocket.
But that counts as a pass from the pocket.
Yeah, I know.
And it's like my all-time – for me, I want – like the numbers say that right now he's the best pocket passer in the league. Tyrod Taylor's up there as well. the best pocket passers in the league are the guys like Carson Palmer to me. They go through progressions. They stand there. They take their steps. They make the reads, and they throw it. If you stand up and throw screen pass to Thomas Rawls from the pocket, that should not have counted. And you're a quarterback, Brady. Am I wrong with that one?
No, you're right. I mean, it's different in evaluating quarterbacks, how they play and all that. I mean, and also say this, you know, Tyrod Taylor, Russell Wilson, both kind of up, you know, more in that category. And I'll even throw Johnny Manziel in it. It's harder to rush those guys because the pass rush can't get too overzealous. Otherwise, if they overrush, right, they create running lanes for them. So they kind of have to, I don't want to say be like geared down, but they have to be under control when they go about trying to pass rush because they want to collapse the pocket. They don't want to allow, you know, too much of an upfield rush that all of a sudden Russell Wilson's able to slip in between the guard and tackle and be able to get out underneath, out in open space. So I think sometimes it actually plays to their benefit because they're mobile, that they can sometimes sit in the pocket and buy a little bit more time because of that.
But I think it should be a stat, easy pocket throws versus tough pockets.
It's like tip picks, too. I've always said it. You know, a guy hits him in the numbers, hits him in the chest, bounce up, you know, DB picks.
Or Hail Mary picks at the end of a half that count against your numbers.
Yeah, anytime. Or throwing it away. I mean, when a guy airmails a ball 20 yards out of bounds, why should that be an incompletion? It should be something else, a different category, because he's not even intending to throw it to anyone else.
He's taking off for the quarterbacks again, Pat.
You know, though, it's the club responsibility. I know stats are being produced for fans and us and all that business. But inside of clubs, we did it ourselves as an example. So we would it'd be downfield throws, and that would be a whole reel. Pocket downfield throws. And the way they program out your video anyway, you can do it yourself. So we did it that way. Same with the running game. We would never evaluate a running back with the draw plays unless we're looking for a third down guy. But rushing yards for a back, forget it. Throw all the draws out on third and 20. Those are out. So we'd have first, second down run reel, and we would look at it. So what you guys are looking for is attainable and findable, to be honest with you, so you don't have to get looking at those generic stats that cover everything. Interceptions covers everything. You know, throwing the ball from the pocket covers everything, and your guys, you know, you're smart enough to know that's not a true picture of what you're looking for. So you can, Brady will tell you can have that sent to your house every night in your computer, Brades.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's where it's kind of gotten ridiculous, where people are always like, oh, we want the quarterback to be in the film room all the time. It's like, dude, some of these guys have families, and they can watch it at home. They can watch it just as much as they want.
Going home.
Yeah, but it's like the, you know, and Pat, you could admit to this. I mean, they want to see that guy in that film room at 6 a.m. every morning when they get there. First guy there, and I was that type of guy. But part of me always felt like I was doing it not necessarily
to make it look good.
To make it look good.
It wasn't necessary. You could have done it at home.
Yeah, I easily could have done it at home. Or, you know, I even worked out at home or whatever else.
Same
but you stay after.
Same with coaches.
Well, thank you for bringing up the coaches, because in New York, and I'm sure this was the same everywhere else, there were beat riders that would come by our parking lot at 10 o'clock at night and see whose cars were there.
Yeah, that happens. There's no doubt.
And then say things like, hey, your car wasn't there last night. You leave early?
And you know, another one too, Pat, there were coaches, and when Coughlin was in Jacksonville, he used to have coaches in the off season make sure they stayed till 5 o'clock on a Friday, so guys would be sitting in their office playing solitaire. I mean, there's nothing to do in the off season on a 5 o'clock on a Friday. Let them go home. They grind all year.
Nope.
You know what it is? It's paralysis by analysis, and it's image. Everybody wants to put the perception out there about
perception
the image.
Perception is reality, though.
Yeah, is it?
You tell me, Pete.
No, reality's reality. Because I'm the ultimate realist. All right, guys. Great one. Awesome. We'll do it again next Monday, Roughing the Passer podcast.